Okay, so this week's parsha is Vayishlach. There is an awful lot going on in this week's parsha. We have Yaakov's encounter with Esav, his preparation for it, the subsequent encounter. The two of them part ways peacefully, somewhat amicably. I'm just going to mute everyone so we don't have too much background noise. And as always, if you have a question, you can unmute yourself. You can even try to chat, but I don't always see the comments right away. But you can try that as well. So they part ways. Yaakov continues on his journey to come back to his father's home in the land of Canaan. And along the way, there is a serious incident where he encounters the city of Shechem, and it's the eponymously named for the prince, a fellow by the name of Shechem. And Shechem kidnaps and he assaults Yaakov's daughter Dinah. And the subsequent trickery or deception that the brothers employ to get their sister back, they tell Shechem and his father Hamor, who are very eager to marry. Shechem is very eager to marry Dinah, and they make an offer. Let's get together and let's marry. You know, let's have our families marry each other, and this will be great, and we can all live happily ever after. There's lots of land. There's lots of business. There's lots of good, nice girls, nice Jewish girls and boys, and lots of nice non-Jewish girls and boys. And let's all get together and we can make one happy nation, live happily ever after. To which the brothers, obviously uninterested in this arrangement, reply and they say, well, if you want to marry into our family, you've got to get circumcised. And so eager are Shechem and his father Hamor, the king of Shechem, to go through with this deal that they convince the entire city to go ahead with this circumcision business. And the Shimon and Levi, who are the main protagonists of the story, come in on the third day when everyone is, well, the men at least, are in their beds moaning and groaning because, you know, this is one of the side effects of circumcision. I don't know what kind of conspiracy theories were going around over there, but there they would have done well to have some good conspiracy theories. And they go in and they wipe out the entire male population of the city. And Yaakov is not thrilled with their actions. There's a lot of discussion about whether halachically they had any right to do what they did. Some say that the fact that the entire city stood by silently and no one protested or did anything to stop this event of what went on, of the kidnapping, excuse me, sorry, and the assault of Dinah, what made them all liable to death. Other commentators disagree and they say, how do you expect a bunch of common citizens to stand up to the king? If you look at what's going on in the world today, you see that that doesn't end well, even in today's world. And certainly in the ancient world where there was no Twitter to protest against it or anything like that, it wouldn't end well. There are other opinions as to why they were allowed to kill them. Yaakov's main objection is not so much whether they were allowed to kill them or not. It seems like according to the letter of the law, they had a right to kill them. But Yaakov's objection is, why in the world are you doing this? You're starting up. And you're going to, you're going to get everyone nervous that this very small fledgling nation, which at this point is just a family, is here to take over. And, you know, everyone's going to attack us. So why are you starting up with them? There were, you know, more diplomatic, or at least somewhat more diplomatic channels you could have employed to save your sister without wiping out the entire city. And that is Yaakov's objection to Shimon and Levi's actions. But they move on. And Yaakov finally arrives home to his father and mother's house. By this time, his mother has passed away. According to Rashi, Rashi tells us that his mother passed away. By the time he got home, he did not actually ever see her again. And then the parsha spends a great deal of time telling us about all of the families and the chiefs and the tribes and the kings of Esav and his descendants. And the parsha, you know, spends quite a while describing and going through all those details as well. So there are different areas we can focus on. I want to focus on Yaakov's meeting with Esav and the historical impact of that meeting, because it really was an historic meeting, not in the sense of that it goes down in the history books. And I apologize, lest you get nervous from this cough. Number one, COVID cannot be transferred over Zoom. Number two, this cough is not from COVID. I went for a run this morning. And I probably ran a little more than I'm used to. And if anyone has ever run more than they're used to, you know that you like dredge up stuff from the bottom of your lungs and so on. So that's kind of why I'm just recovering from that run this morning. So I apologize. That's why I'm keep clearing my throat as well. So I want to focus on this meeting. Seemingly, this is an isolated incident where Yaakov is returning from his sojourn by Laban's house. He's coming back, and here comes Esav with 400 men, ostensibly to attack Yaakov. So despite the passage of years and Rivka's hope that Esav's rage at Yaakov would subside over the passage of years, but seemingly Esav is out for blood, and he's coming to attack Yaakov. And Yaakov is very, very fearful of this, and Yaakov prepares for this meeting in a number of ways. He prays to Hashem, he prepares for war, and he prepares for flight if need be as well. And he also sends a gift. He sends a bribe to Esav in the hope that this gift slash bribe, call it what you want, will placate Esav. Now, the Medrash finds fault in Yaakov. And the way the Medrash says it is that God, so to speak, said to Yaakov, why are you pulling, this is an idiom in Hebrew, Lama toichaz ba'oznei akelev? Why are you pulling the ears of the dog? In English, we would say it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Okay, and that is why if you ever pass a sleeping dog and the sleeping dog is uttering falsehoods, just leave it alone, because it's best to let sleeping dogs fly to lie. So, but Yaakov is seen over here that the end of that Yaakov sent messengers to Esav with a message of peace, ostensibly. That's how the parsha opens up. And then the very next verse says that the messengers return and they say, we came to your brother, and he's headed towards you with 400 men. And the Medrash understands that what actually took place was Esav was kind of minding his own business. And Yaakov sent messengers to Esav, which kind of roused Esav from his slumber, so to speak, and said, oh, Yaakov's coming back. I'm going to go get him. And if Yaakov hadn't sent those messengers to Esav, then this whole situation would not have occurred in the first place. It was because Yaakov kind of started up with Esav, now maybe in a fashion of appeasing him, but the bottom line is that Yaakov is taken to task by Chazal, by the sages, see that Yaakov here seemingly made an error in starting up with Esav, and he could have avoided the whole thing if he would have just leave well enough alone. And at the same time, before I get to the same time, so that is something that I want to try to explore a little bit. Why did Yaakov do this? Why indeed did Yaakov do it? Seemingly, it seems to be an egregious error on his part. If Esav is indeed not looking for a fight, if Esav is just, living in Seir where he was, minding his own business, and Yaakov's on his way back, and Esav is not out to get Yaakov, why does Yaakov decide to send a message to Esav? Hi, Esav! I'm back! Why do that? Why? Even if you want to placate him, but why start up with him at all? And I think that, so that question, it needs to be answered. Why did Yaakov, indeed, why did he start up with Esav? Yes, the Medrash says that Hashem found fault with Yaakov for doing it, but the question is, why did Yaakov do it in the first place? Okay, we have to understand Yaakov was a great tzaddik, a very righteous man. He was no fool by any stretch of the imagination. He was a smart man, and he knew exactly what he had to do. So why did he go ahead and do this? So we need to understand why this meeting is so historic, not just because it's in the Torah, not just because the future of the entire Jewish nation was at stake because Esav was out to destroy them, but many sources, including the Talmud itself, and later sources expand on this, they say, we have an idea which I've mentioned many times in this class, and that is, we have an idea called Maisa Avos Simon Labanim, which means the events that occur to the patriarchs and to the tribes are a sign for the children, for their descendants. Meaning, again, I discussed this idea many times, the book of Bereishis is called Sefer HaYetzirah, which means the book of formation. And it's not just in English, or in Greek, I should say, it's called Genesis, okay, which means the formation. That is basically what Genesis translates to. And by the way, parenthetically, all the Greek names of the five books of the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, are actually based on names that were given much, much earlier by Torah sources to describe the theme of each book. So Genesis is called Sefer Yetzirah, which is the book of formation. The book of Shemos is called Exodus, is based on Sefer HaGeula, the book of redemption, which we'll have to talk about when we get there, God willing, in a few weeks' time. The book of Vayikra is called Toras Kohanim, which means the laws of the Kohanim, or the priests, and it's called Leviticus, which means the laws of the Levites. Numbers, because it talks about the counting of the Jewish people, is called Sefer HaPakudim, which means the book of numbers, or of counting. And Deuteronomy, don't ask me exactly what that means, but do means doubling. In Hebrew, it's called Mishnah Torah, which means, in a sense, the doubling of the Torah, because there are many laws that are repeated in the book of Devarim, and we have to talk about that as well, why that's so. That's a long parenthetical idea. But Bereshit is called Sefer Yetzirah, the book of formation. And the idea is not just that it describes the early history of the world and of human history, but rather it talks about the formation, the foundations of the laying of the foundations and the roots of the world and of the Jewish people. And the book of Exodus details the Jewish people growing into a nation. And we'll have to talk about that there. But the book of Bereshit ends with the death of Joseph in Egypt and the nascent Jewish nation, the 12 tribes and their immediate family, and Yaakov going into Egypt. And it is the book of formation, but it's also on a deeper level. It is laying, like I said, the foundations and the roots from which the tree will grow. And whatever you have in the roots, that's what you have in the tree. The spiritual DNA that is laid down during the book of Bereshit by the Avos and the Imos, by the patriarchs and the matriarchs, by the tribes, that spiritual DNA is being created in the roots and the foundation, and that will be expressed in a full tree that will blossom and grow forth with a lot of struggles, to be sure, in the book of Shemos. And so we have this very, very vital, important idea called Maisa Avosim and Labanim, that whatever happens to the patriarchs and the matriarchs and the tribes is a sign for future generations. It's more than just a sign. It is really, on a deeper level, it is they are creating a spiritual DNA, so to speak, which will be fully expressed in their descendants. And so everything that goes on is expressed in various forms by their descendants later. And I've touched on this a number of times in classes in recent weeks. For our discussion right now, the idea is as follows. Yaakov is in exile. And as I mentioned, I think last week, Yaakov's journey from the land of Canaan, which will later be the land of Israel, to exile. He has to flee for his life, to flee from the clutches of his murderous brother Esav. And he goes to his uncle Laban's house and he has to survive there. And he's persecuted and he's cheated and he's hounded and he's chased and so on. And only God stepping in at the last minute saves him, or God stepping in, actually, I should say, consistently saves him. But Laban is ready to wipe out the entire family. And Hashem steps in and tells Laban, don't you touch a hair on his head. So that is looked at as the prototype for exile of the Jewish people in future generations. And so we need to examine very carefully Yaakov's behavior in exile, how he deals with Laban, how he deals with Esav, to learn the lessons of how a Jew should behave in exile. And it's recorded in the Talmud that the leaders of the Jewish people during the Roman era, there were different eras, if you will, during the period of Roman rule over the Jewish people, which spanned centuries. And at different points, the relationship sometimes was better, sometimes was worse. We tend to focus on the worst times, and there were plenty of those, but sometimes things were better. Sometimes there were edicts or decrees against the Jewish people and so on, and the Talmud is replete with stories of sages who went to Rome to intercede on behalf of their Jewish brethren who were under Roman rule. And there are a lot of stories. And the Talmud says that some of these leaders, before they would go meet with the Roman rulers, they would study Parshas Vayishlach. They would go over Yaakov's encounter with Esav. Why? Because Esav is the progenitor of Rome. Okay, if you look at the very end of the Parsha, almost at the end, where it talks about a bunch of Esav's children, so one of them listed over there is someone named Magdiel. And Rashi says Magdiel is the founder of Rome. I can't comment on Remus and Romulus being raised by wolves or whatnot. That I'm not aware of any indication in the Torah. but the nation of Rome descends from Asaph. And if you think about it, and we've discussed this idea in recent weeks, if it's very nicely, as I mentioned, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, Asaph's role is domination of the physical world, development and domination of the physical world. And that is exactly what Rome does. Rome dominates, controls, holds power over the civilized world for centuries, and they also develop the civilized world enormously. The word Asaph is cognate from the word word asiya, to do, to accomplish, to make, to in the physical world. And Rome's achievements in that realm of building up the physical world are enormous. You know, it's called Europe after the sacking of Rome. Europe descends into the Dark Ages, where they lose all of that knowledge and all of that technology that Rome had developed and so on. But there's no question that Rome and Western civilization even today is predicated on much of what Rome stood for and the ideals that they developed in terms of society, in terms of developing the world and so on and so forth. So Asaph, when we talk about that, even today, the Jewish people are still in the Roman exile, because we're still in the exile that Rome exiled us into, even though Rome is long defunct, although to be clear, the seat of Christianity, Catholicism, yes, there's Protestantism, but Catholicism, which is the original Christianity, is still located where? In Rome. So if we look at, you know, the Western world as being a world that is predicated primarily on Christianity and what they like to call today Judeo-Christian ideals and so on, morals, but it's really very, very much Christian. You know, the Western civilization, whether they actually believe in any real religion or not, or practice it today, but it's still predicated on the morals and the ideals of Christianity, for better or for worse, depending on where and when you live. But the seat of Christianity is still in Rome. So we're still being dominated by Rome, even if in America, you know, the majority of the population is not Catholic per se. But that idea that Rome is the dominant force of Western civilization, where the majority of Jews live today, the vast majority of Jews live in the Western world, in Western culture and so on, is certainly true. So Yaakov, his encounter with Esau is instructive for how a Jew deals with a dominant government, culture, and so on in exile. So let's just examine what Yaakov does and see how it's been applied historically for a couple of minutes. And then we'll try to get back to our original question. Why did Yaakov start up with Esau? So Yaakov, as we said, he sends messengers to Esau, and they come back and they say, Esau is out to wipe you out. He's got 400 soldiers with him. Rashi says, in fact, that these 400 men were not the entirety of the army. They were, in fact, the generals over the units of his army. So actually, his army was far, far larger. And Yaakov, it says that Yaakov was Vayir Yaakov Ma'od. Yaakov was very fearful. The word Ma'od in the Torah translates as very, but really the word Ma'od means, in a sense, like beyond normal. Okay, so in other words, Yaakov's fear was beyond the normal pale of a person panicking or being fearful. And Yaakov was extremely concerned with this encounter. Rashi discusses exactly what he's concerned with and so on. It's not my discussion right now. But Yaakov, as I said before, does three things. Thing number one that he does is he prepares for battle / flight. He prepares to wage war with Esau, and he splits his camp in two. And he says that if Esau defeats one camp, at least the other camp can escape. So we'll have some sort of a remnant that will survive. Number two, he sends a substantial gift to Esau.
I have a question.
Hang on one second, let's finish. I'll take a question. And the third thing he does, he prays to God. Those are the three things he does. Yeah, go ahead.
It says that all the women came forward and bowed before Esau. So how far away were these two camps?
Well, eventually they. Oh, you mean, okay, so you're, okay, let me backtrack. You're asking an excellent question. What you're asking is, seemingly by the time Yaakov actually showed up to Esau, everyone was there. What happened to splitting the camp in two? Yes, that is an excellent question. I had this question for quite a while. I have not actually found a write-up about it. I probably have not looked hard enough. But years ago, I heard the following answer. Okay, and that is a very important piece, which I skipped in my narrative of the parsha. And that is, the night before Yaakov is to meet Esau, he meets someone else at night. Who does he meet? The Torah says he meets a man with whom he fights the entire night. And Rashi tells us that this man was actually not a human, but was actually an angel. And he was none other than Esav's ministering angel. And Esav's ministering angel is none other than Satan himself. Okay, because Esav has become so completely sucked into the evil of the world that Esav and evil have actually become one and the same. So that to the extent that Esav's ministering angel is Satan himself. All right. So if you want to put it into more contemporary pop culture terms, he has completely given himself over to the dark side. And so in any event, whether or not there's any good left in him or not is a discussion for another time. But there's talk about that as well. And you can apply whatever pop culture you like to that. So getting back over here to answer your question, the answer that I heard, I don't remember where I heard it, where I saw it, is that Yaakov was actually victorious over that angel. And once Yaakov was victorious over that angel, so he knew that spiritually he had already been victorious over Esav, and he knew that therefore he would not be defeated by Esav the next day. And consequently, while he still had to go through the motions of the process of meeting Esav and being subservient to him, he was no longer concerned that he would be wiped out by Esav, and therefore he abandoned the plan to split in two, because once he was victorious over the angel of Esav, that would trickle down into the physical world, and I should better say, it would devolve into the physical world, and he would not be wiped out by Esav. That's an answer I heard. It's a somewhat satisfying answer. It's not a completely satisfying answer, but if you come across anything, let me know, because it is a question that's been in my mind for a number of years, so it is a good question. Okay? So getting back over here. So these are the three things Yaakov did. Historically, the Jewish people have engaged in these methods. There's no question that whenever the Jewish people in exile have been faced with a threat from without, or even from within, but certainly from without, from their host nation. And we've been through many host nations, and we've faced many, many threats. Some worse, some even worse, some worser, some the worst, and so on and so forth. Prayer has always been the modus operandi of the Jewish people, to pray to God for salvation. But we don't stop with just prayer. We also engage in dealing with the host nation, the host government. And historically, the way the Jewish people have always dealt with the host government is to try to bribe their way out of things. Historically, this was always the way things went. Always. Is that the Jewish people will always try to offer gifts, bribes, and so on and so forth to buy off the government and to prevent the government from issuing harsh decrees. There are innumerable stories throughout history, some probably apocryphal, some urban legends, some are true, some are not. Separating fact from fiction is not always easy. Sometimes it is. Sometimes you hear a story and you just know it could not have happened just based on the dates or some of the details and so on. Of course, then sometimes you have like a 30-second story that gets embellished into a 3-hour story with lots of details added that simply could not have happened. So if you're talking about a rabbi in the 1500s making a phone call to his wife on the way to the king, that probably didn't happen. But there's no question throughout history, whichever stories are true or not true or are embellished and so on, that the Jewish people throughout the history in exile have always tried to placate the ruling power of the host nation in order to avoid getting into too much trouble. That has been the case throughout. And even if you look at the history, during the period of the Holocaust, there are many stories, and this is well documented, of attempts by Jewish activists in parts of Europe that were not under Nazi domination completely, parts of Hungary before the Nazis marched in America and in other parts of the world, where there were huge, huge efforts undertaken to buy Jewish lives from the Nazis. There's the famous Trucks for Lives story with Rabbi Weissmandel. You could Google the story, Rabbi Michel Ber Weissmandel, who organized a deal with Eichmann himself to give a significant payment, I think, of trucks and of military equipment in exchange for saving thousands of Jewish lives. There was a famous train called the Kastner train, which you may have heard of, which saved a lot of Jews, including famously the Satmar Rebbe and a lot of other notables from Hungary, which was like an expression of goodwill, if you will, from the Nazis, that they sent off one train and saved hundreds, if not thousands of hundreds of Jews from being deported to the death camps during the negotiations. Ultimately, the negotiations fell through. There was a lot of opposition in America because they didn't want to give military equipment or money to the Nazis, even though the Nazis were rapidly losing the war by that point. This was 1944. And, there was a lot of politics and so on and so forth. But even during the Holocaust, attempts at buying off the enemy to save Jewish lives was engaged in the years leading up to the Spanish expulsion. The Abarbanel, Rabbi Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, who was the treasurer for Ferdinand and Isabella, attempted to buy their canceling of the expulsion decree. And there was actually a lot of back and forth. The story goes that, he made a lot of impassioned pleas to Isabella and to Ferdinand to cancel the decree. And the story goes, I don't remember all the details, but the basic story goes that at one point he was actually making a dent in Isabella's resolve. Isabella was the main driver of the expulsion decree. Ferdinand was kind of dragged behind her. And Isabella's confessor was a fellow by the name of, anybody? You can unmute yourself. Isabella.
Rossi.
Huh?
I thought maybe a Spanish sage.
Isabella's confessor, her Catholic priest confessor, was a fellow by the name of Thomas de Torquemada.
Oh,
you may have heard his name.
I didn't know.
He was the one behind the expulsion decree. He was the one who pushed Isabella and Ferdinand to make the decree. And the story goes that at one point, Donis Abarbanel, who was the treasurer and a very wealthy man in his own right, and whom Ferdinand and Isabella desperately wanted to keep as their treasurer, and he said and actually did, he left, even though he was told he could get an exception. He could stay and remain Jewish. But at one point, when it seemed like he was close to making a breakthrough, the story goes that Torquemada stormed into the court of the king and queen and threw a cross at her feet. And I remember the exact details, but something to the effect of told her that she should step on it or spit on it or something like that if she, gives in to the Abarbanel's demands. And that hardened Isabella's resolve to go through with the expulsion decree. So there is no question throughout history that the Jewish people have relied heavily on what became known as askonos. And that's even today. Askonos means, the word asik means to be involved. And you always had individuals in the Jewish community throughout history who were involved in dealing with the government for the welfare of the Jewish communities. And even today, you have organizations like Agudat Israel, who are regarded as the major askonim, the major intercessors on behalf of the Jewish people in America. And they will often put out statements and so on, but they're always very carefully worded, diplomatically worded and so on and so forth. So whereas you might have some Jews screaming for blood or wanting to protest and so on and so forth loudly, very often there's pushback that let's go through the channels of diplomacy and of what we call askonis, a normal intercession, because that is usually the best way to do things. Now, Yaakov said, yeah, go ahead.
Wouldn't that be with the Ethiopians? They've bribed to get the Ethiopians out and some of the Yemenites.
Probably, if that's what happened.
A lot of the Arab Jews from Arab, which are now Arab countries, but they'd been there way before the Arabs even. They bribed and tried to get them out after 48 because they were being murdered and they were kicked out anyway and everything taken from them.
Yeah.
Or they were hung. Some were hung.
Yeah.
As a little notice of, we're putting you on notice of what we can do here.
Yes.
And they sure did.
Yeah, yeah. You are correct. The events after 48, the world is very happy to turn the blind eye to all that, as they focus on, a bunch of Arabs getting thrown out of their homes during the War of Independence and the millions of Jews that got thrown out of their homes. The Arab countries, no one gives two hoots about. You are correct. But U.S., I don't know exact history, but you are saying that a lot of, bribes were paid and so on. There's no question in the Arab countries as well. There are, like I said, numerous stories, especially the end of the Ottoman Empire when, the rulers were just a bunch of overindulgent, which is why the Ottoman Empire crumbled. Bribing the Ottoman Empire rulers was a daily endeavor. But this is the but. At the same time, Yaakov readied himself for war. And the approach has been that if all else fails, then the Jewish people do sometimes fight back. And again, this gets into a whole, can of worms over here about Jewish resistance during World War II and so on, which is not my discussion today. And I'm a little short on time. I have to stop in the next few minutes. Maybe we need a longer discussion. about Jewish resistance during the Holocaust. But I can give you one example where during the famous Warsaw Ghetto uprising, there was enormous discussion among the rabbis, the rabbinic authorities in the Warsaw Ghetto. Should they endorse a Warsaw Ghetto uprising or not? And there was a lot of discussion. And the point was, do we say that if we just try to keep placating the Nazi the Nazi forces and try to keep placating them and meet their demands, is it inevitable we're all going to be killed anyways, in which case we're just pushing off the inevitable, and therefore we have very little to lose by fighting back. And a number of rabbinic authorities believed that it was warranted at that point that they should fight back because they were all going to die regardless. And so there is a point where Jews say it's time to fight back. And again, I'm not getting into the politics of the state of Israel and how early state of Israel viewed those who were killed in the Holocaust and kind of mocked them as people who did not fight back. And we, the strong new Jewish people of Israel, we will fight back and so on. I'm not getting involved in that right now. Okay. But just to make the point that, again, that there have been points in history where the Jewish people have fought back after all diplomatic channels have failed. But the first channel is Yaakov placates Esav with a gift. And ultimately, Yaakov does not have to fight Esav because his gift succeeds in calming Esav down, in appeasing Esav. He submits himself to Esav. And this is indeed the prototypical Jew in exile. Indeed, we are in exile. We're not meant to rule and to be in charge and to have power. We are meant to submit ourselves to the host nation and to try to placate them. And that is Yaakov's approach. And in this case, it is successful. So getting back to our original question, why does Yaakov start up with Esav? So one of the Hasidic commentators says the following idea. He says, you're right, Yaakov in this situation would have been better off not starting off with Esav. However, Yaakov prophetically knew that his descendants are going to have to engage with Esav's descendants, the Romans. They're going to have to deal with them. And because we have this idea that the patriarchs are laying the DNA, the spiritual DNA, for their descendants to succeed as a nation through history, in good times and bad, Yaakov prophetically knows that his descendants, the Jewish people, are going to go through very difficult exiles, and they're going to be persecuted, and they're going to be hounded, and they're going to be chased and robbed and murdered and tortured and so on. Yaakov needs to lay the groundwork for how you deal with an Esav, how you deal with your enemy, how do you deal with them. And if Yaakov takes the easy route and he just avoids Esav, which in this circumstance particularly would have made sense, don't pull the dog's ears. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Don't start up with them. But Yaakov sees prophetically that his descendants are not going to have that good fortune of avoiding any encounter with their enemies. They're going to have to deal with them. And so Yaakov says, it's worth it for me to get into this mess and deal with Esav in order to lay the spiritual groundwork for the success of my descendants. They will have to do this. So if I don't do it now, then they're not going to have that spiritual power. They're not going to have this program into their DNA, the ability to do this properly, to be able to survive in exile. And therefore, Yaakov saw fit that even though he's going to have to start with Esav unnecessarily, it's worth it to be able to lay that groundwork for his descendants. Okay? So what is the upshot for us? The upshot for us is that we are in exile. And even though sometimes protests are called for, sometimes Jews taking up arms is called for, in a general sense, we need to think very, very carefully over what the proper approach is. A knee-jerk reaction to something is not always the proper approach. During the 70s and 80s, when there was a lot of movement among the Jewish communities on behalf of Russian Jewry, there was pushback from a lot of corners in the Orthodox world that these protests are not necessarily productive. Sometimes they were, but sometimes they weren't. But there was a lot of concern among the rabbinic leadership that these protests, if they get out of hand, which they often did, are counterproductive because they'll get out of hand. And instead of trying to make a point, you're just going to get people angry at you. Okay, and again, it needs a careful balance and judgment over what the proper approach is. Not always is it appropriate to make a lot of noise. It's generally best to keep a low profile in exile. Yes, Ethel, go ahead.
Okay, and after this encounter, Jacob tells Esau, okay, we'll meet up in Seir. But he lied.
Kind of.
No, he lied.
Rashi says that he eventually plans on getting there in the Messianic era with the ultimate day of judgment.
Someday, okay.
Yes. In other words, it wasn't an outright lie. It was a it was a bending the truth of sorts, or, you know.
But the bit is that he totally went the other way. Wasn't that kind of inviting, all right, now come after me?
It's a good question. I would guess that Yaakov felt that once Esav goes on his way, even if Yaakov doesn't show up later, Esav's not going to come looking for him. I would assume that was what Yaakov felt, that Esav at that point was inviting Yaakov to travel with him. And Yaakov, obviously, for a lot of reasons, which I don't have time to discuss now, was not interested in that offer. Okay, you have to be wary of Esav both when he attacks you and when he's too friendly to you, you know, because assimilation into Western culture when they're too friendly is a major problem also, as we see in America. And Yaakov wasn't interested. So Yaakov kind of, in Yiddish, we say he drayed out of it, you know, which means he kind of, he drayed out of it, means he spun his way out of it. And I would guess, again, I don't have more information, you know, to fully answer your question, but I would guess that Yaakov judged the situation that once Esav goes in his way, you know, they've parted ways. And Esav perhaps himself kind of realized that Yaakov was telling him, like, you know, maybe some other time. You know, thank you for the offer. Don't call me, I'll call you, kind of thing. And they agreed to part ways.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to have to call it a day here. So thank you all for coming. Hopefully next week we will be back in session in person. We'll keep an eye on the situation and stay tuned. Okay. Take care. Have a great week, everyone.